Chapter 8. The Foundations. The world order controls the citizens of the United States through the tax-exempt foundations. These foundations create and implement government policy through their staff members in key positions in the executive, legislative, and judiciary departments. The foundations create educational policy through their staff members in key positions at every level of the educational system. The foundations control religious doctrine through their staff members in key positions in the leading religious denominations. Foundation is a misleading term. Webster calls it an endowment, but a foundation is really a trust, which Rogett states is a syndicate. If, instead of Rockefeller Foundation, we were to say Rockefeller Syndicate, we would be much closer to the truth. Alpheus T. Mason, in his biography of Justice Brandeis, quotes Brandeis as pointing out that socialism has been developed largely by the power of individual trusts. What we have then are criminal syndicates masquerading as philanthropic enterprises, while they inflict socialist world slavery on nations and peoples for the benefit of the world order. Norman Dodd, director of research for the Rees Committee in its attempt to investigate tax-exempt foundations, was asked by Congressman B. Carroll Rees in January, 1954, "Do you accept the premise that the United States is the victim of a conspiracy?" "Yes," said Dodd. "Then," said Congressman Rees, "you must conduct the investigation on that basis." B. E. Hutchinson, chairman of Chrysler Corporation, although approving the goals of the investigation, warned Dodd, "If you proceed, as you have outlined, you will be killed." Dodd stated, "The foundation world is a coordinated, well-directed system, the purpose of which is to ensure that the wealth of 191. Our country shall be used to divorce it from the ideas which brought it into being. The foundations are the biggest single influence in collectivism." The 1975 report of the Rockefeller Foundation's Howard S. 100,000 grant to the Institute for World Order, operated by Professor Saul Mendelovitz, who states in the Institute publication Transition, October 1974, "I am arguing for a new governance or alternative institutions to those now responsible for global concert. People will be demanding a central guidance system. It means a governance is about to come into being in which the policy elites in various nation states who have the authority and capacity to make decisions will no longer have that as their prerogative. There will be a governance that will say, you can't build an army anymore. You must give a certain amount of your economic income to other areas of the world. In short, a world order, no national armies, no private incomes, no individual freedom." Ironically, all this is being financed by those who created wealth by the exercise of individual freedom in the United States. Mendelovitz does not use the word government, which might imply government by the consent of the people, as in the United States. He uses governance, the imperial form, meaning a dictatorial decree. Every act of the foundation syndicates, and of their masters in the world order, is intended to implement a ruthless type of Oriental despotism. As is traditional in this type of despotism, the most efficient palace servants are eunuchs. Eunuchs work for little or no pay, because they do not have the expense of rearing families. In the foundation world, we find the eunuch as the predominant type of official. The eunuchs move in and out of the foundations into prominent posts in government, education, and religion. Although they may marry and have children, psychologically they remain eunuchs, those who have forsworn their manhood to become palace servants of the world order. Columnist Jeffrey Hart recently commented on this type, referring to Mondale's selection of Geraldine F. Ferraro as his vice presidential nominee. Mondale should have chosen a man, in order to balance the ticket. We well may ask, if the world order is in control, why do we need an institute for world order? Why do we need the foundations, as gauleiters of the order's control? The answer is that the world order rules, because it conceals its power, it denies that it exists. Although its power is obvious everywhere, in the government, in education, in the religious orders, in the wars and revolutions and famines which are so meticulously planned and executed, the world order, like the mafia, refuses to acknowledge its own existence. Its subsidiaries come and go, but the order remains constant. When too many people discover the Council on Foreign Relations, power is moved into the Bilderbergers, or the Trilateral Commission. The order's control remains constant. The New York Times noted April 29, 1984 that 1,400 officials were attending the annual meeting of the Council on Foundations. There were 21,697 foundations in the U.S., which in 1983 distributed $3.4 billion in grants. These grants are dispensed only to those who implement the program of the world order, and whose goal is world slavery. The international banking families, whose origins go back to the Middle Ages, set up the principal American foundations to protect the wealth they had amassed in their dealings in slaves, drugs, and gold, and to perpetuate that wealth through means which can only be described as imperial decrees, government charters, in order to neutralize all potential rivals or opposition by controlling them and directing or misdirecting their opposition. None of the charters of the foundations indicate their real purpose. They are replete with such phrases as the well-being of mankind, the elimination of poverty, the elimination of disease, the promotion of world brotherhood, compassion, caring, charity. These are the watchwords of the foundations. There is no hint to the unwary of the despotic instincts which drive these caring people to promote world. 192. 193. Wars and world slavery. Nor is there any warning to the menials of the foundations that, if they falter at any time in their dedication to the goals of the world order, the penalty is sudden death. Few American citizens can grasp the disturbing fact that the governing power in the United States is not a government agency, or laws, or political parties. Rather, it is the power of the assassins, those behind-the-scenes figures who have the power to order the assassination of anyone whom they can no longer control. We have seen two presidents of the United States, Abraham Lincoln and John Fitzgerald Kennedy, assassinated because they ordered the Treasury of the United States to print non-interest-bearing dollar bills, a development which threatened to deprive the international bankers of billions of dollars in unearned profits. For 5,000 years, the code name of the assassins has been the Canaanites, see The Curse of Canaan, by Eustace Mullins. This was the assassins' own name for themselves, symbolized by the initials N, in Aramaic, which in Greek meant the Canaanites. They were also called zealots, or zealots, as fanatics who were willing to commit murder for their cause. To the world, they were known as assassins, originating in modern times, as a Judea Shiite sect founded by a Persian, Hassan Saba, in 1090. He had been initiated into the Grand Lodge of Cairo, and traveled throughout Persia organizing the assassins as a missionary under the protection of Abu Mansur Sadiq ibn Yusuf, who, although he was Jewish, had risen to the eminence of Vizier Dhof Caliph al-Mustansir. In India, the fansigars, or stranglers, got their name from a Hindustani fancy, a noose. In northern India, they were called thugs, or deceivers. In Tamil, they were called Eritulukar, or Musulman noosers, in Kanarese, Tanti Kalaru, or thieves, who use a wire or catgut noose. We mention the Oriental correspondence of our present-day assassins, those who rule by terrorism in the United States, because they have the same origins, the same loyalties, and the same goal, the rule of the world order. Many eunuchs who became a liability to the world order have been eliminated without mercy. When Hiss, White and others faced 194. Congressional investigation, many of their acquaintances became casualties. A lawyer named Marvin Smith, a close friend of Hiss, fell out of a window. Lawrence Duggan, an intimate of both Hiss and White, W., as slated to testify, when he fell out of a 12th-story window. Duggan was an official of the Institute of International Education, of which his father was founder and president, but these family ties offered him no protection. In his haste to get to the window, he tore off one shoe, and left his office in a shambles, as he fought his way across it. The verdict was suicide. The Canadian diplomat, Herbert Norman, and the Harvard professor F.O. Matthiessen, also went out the window, before they could be made to testify about their associations. The phenomena became so common that it gave rise to a new term, defenestration, meaning the avoidance of testimony, and a suitable warning to others who might think of talking. We have read ad nauseam about men of great wealth who, after careers of astounding ruthlessness, while amassing their fortunes, suddenly underwent a profound conversion, like Paul, and became men of goodwill. It is true that the benefactions of the Carnegies and the Rockefellers are the most potent influences in American life today. They collect ever higher taxes, increase the control of government over every aspect of human life, and plan more wars and revolutions to further their goals. From the outset, American foundations have exhibited a twofold image. In front is the tireless Joe-gooder who balks at nothing, if it serves a good cause. Behind him are the evil conspirators who are intent on preserving and increasing their wealth and power. The foundation in its present form originated in the concept of a Boston family, the Peabodys. Henry James, in his novel The Bostonians, ridiculed a family friend, Elizabeth Peabody, for her 50 years of relentless humanitarian zeal, portraying her as the legendary Miss Birdsey. George Peabody, after slave trading operations in Washington and Baltimore, moved to London, where he was set up as a front by the Rothschild family. He amassed a fortune by buying up depressed stock in American panics, and chose a Boston trader, Junius Morgan, to carry on his business. In 1865, Peabody set 195 up the first larger-scale American foundation, the Peabody Educational Fund, endowing it with $1 million in government bonds. By 1867, this had grown to $2 million, by 1869, $3.6 million. Ostensibly set up to educate Southern Negroes after the Civil War, it was a key operation in the carpetbagger strategy to gain control of Southern lands and to control their state governments. These states had to borrow heavily from Wall Street bankers to rebuild their services, and they remained deeply in debt for the next century. Because of its international connections, the Peabody Fund attracted a stellar board of directors. General Ulysses Grant served on its board for 18 years, Grover Cleveland served 14 years, McKinley 2 years, Theodore Roosevelt 13 years. J.P. Morgan served on the board for 28 years and never missed a meeting. His partner, Anthony Drexel, served 1-2 years. A fund with similar goals was the John F. Slater Fund for the Education of Freedmen, established by John F. Slater, 1815-1884, a wealthy northern textile manufacturer. Set up with $1 million, by 1882, it had grown to $4 million. The three original trustees were President Rutherford B. Hayes, Daniel Coit Gilman, and Morris K. Jessup, treasurer. When John D. Rockefeller discovered that the foundations offered the road to world power, the Peabody Fund proved to be his model. He and his director of charity, Frederick T. Gates, set up the Southern Educational Board, which merged with the Peabody and Slater funds. They later set up the General Education Board, which absorbed its three predecessors. Its Kurtzstetebfitt's purpose was the promotion of education within the USA without distinctions of race, creed, or sex. Its goals were a racial amalgamation unto abolition of distinctions between the sexes. Its incorporators included its first president, William H. Baldwin Jr., President Long Island Railroad, formerly with Union Pacific, the Harriman Schiff Operation, Frederick T. Gates, Rockefeller's right-hand man, Daniel Coit Gilman, Vice President. Peabody Fund and the Slater Fund, President University of California 1872-75. President John Hopkins University 1875-1901, and first president of the Carnegie Institute. Gilman was an original incorporator of the Russell Sage Foundation and the Carnegie Institute. The fact that one man was 196. An incorporator of the three most influential foundations in America shows how centralized the control of these supposedly autonomous foundations has always been by a few ruthless individuals. Gilman is usually listed as a charter member of the World Order, because he, together with Andrew Dixon White and Timothy Dwight, set up the Russell Trust at Yale in 1856, to finance the Skull and Bones organization, whose members are the leading front men in America. W. Averell Harriman, President George Bush, and propagandist William Buckley of the National Review are typical members. Norman Dodd, also a Yale man, said, "It was well known on campus that, if you were tapped for bones, you would never have to worry about success in later life." Of the three founders of this order, Dwight became president of Yale. White, son of a railroad millionaire, was said by the New York Times to have inherited enough money to make him free from care for life. He became the first president of Cornell University, and gave the institution $300,000 to set up its school of government. He became the first president of the American Historical Association, and was U.S. Ambassador to Russia 189-294, and ambassador to Germany 1897-1902. His final legacy was to advise Herbert Hoover to set up the Hoover Institution. However, it is with the third founder, Daniel Coit Gilman, with whom we are most concerned. Gilman trained John Dewey in collectivist theories of education at Johns Hopkins University. Dewey went on to head the University of Chicago School of Education, and later Teachers College at Columbia University, two of the leading Fabian socialist schools in the world. Gilman, through his protege, Dewey, has dominated American education throughout the 20th century. Gilman also trained Richard Healy at the Johns Hopkins Department of Economics. Healy later taught Woodrow Wilson, whom he describes as unusual, brilliant. Thus Gilman's influence extended through Healy to Woodrow Wilson, who gave us the Federal Reserve System, the income tax, and the First World War. 197. Although American, the three founders of this order were educated at the University of Berlin, where they were indoctrinated in the Hegelian philosophy of determinism. This philosophy of education and government teaches that everyone can be controlled and must be controlled in order to achieve predetermination. Is the philosophy of Oriental despotism transferred to Europe and adapted to the greater individuality of the European peoples, from whom most Americans are descended. As founder Frederick T. Gates wrote in the General Education Board Occasional Paper No. 1, in our dreams we have limitless resources and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and, unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive rural folk. The members of the world order regard everyone as a peasant. They have only contempt for those who are too naive to see that they are being robbed, tricked and enslaved. Other original directors of General Education Board included Morris K. Jessup, a banker who had been treasurer of the Peabody and Slater funds. He was a director of Western Union, a Kool-Aid-controlled company, Metropolitan Trust, and Atlantic Mutual Insurance. Robert C. Ogden of John Wanamaker Company, who served as president of Southern Educational Board, Tuskegee Institute, Union Theological Seminary, and Hampton Institute. Walter Hines Page, who, as an ambassador to Britain, helped involve us in World War I. Sir Roderick Jones, chief of Reuters News Agency at its historic address, 24 Old Jewry, London, relates a bit of history in his autobiography, A Life in Reuters, A Luncheon Given by him for General Smuts, Sir Star Jameson, and Dr. Walter Hines Page, all three of whom had Rothschild connections. We dined in a private room at the Wyndham Club, the one in which 20 years later the terms of the abdication of King Edward VII were settled. We drifted on to the question of the U.S. entering the war, for which Britain and France so patiently waited. Dr. Page then revealed to us, under seal of secrecy, that he had received from the 19th president that afternoon a personal communication upon the strength of which he could affirm that, at last, the die was cast. Consequently, it was not without emotion that he found himself able to assure us that the U.S. would be at war with the Central Powers inside a week from that date. The ambassador's assurance was correct to the day. We dined on Friday, March 30th. On April 2, President Wilson asked Congress to declare a state of war with Germany. On April 6, the U.S. was at war. Can anyone fail to make a connection between the director of a charity designed to control the education of every citizen of the U.S., and its director who conspired to involve us in a world war? Another incorporator of General Education Board was George Foster Peabody, a member of the family which had set up the Peabody Fund. He married Katrina Trask, relict of Spencer Trask, a wealthy stockbroker who specialized in railroad issues. Their estate, Yaddo, a magnificent upstate mansion, was left as a foundation to provide writers and artists a place to work. The grantees, one need not add, have been unanimously and relentlessly liberal in their philosophy and work, although they have regrettably failed to produce any significant contributions to American art or literature. Spencer Trask had been killed when someone shunted a freight train onto the line carrying his sumptuous private car. George Foster Peabody promptly moved into Yaddo with Katrina, and lived 10 years with her before marrying her in 1921. She died shortly thereafter, and Peabody adopted a lissom young divorcee, Marjorie White, when he was informed the church would not allow him to marry her. He then appointed her sister, Elizabeth Ames, director of Yaddo, where she remained as virtual dictator for many years. The music room at Yaddo displays a large bronze plaque which reads, George Foster Peabody, Lover of Men. Peabody was appointed the first director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in 1914, serving during the crucial years of World War I, until 1921. He was an enthusiastic supporter of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, and later became a director of FDR's Warm Springs Foundation, and the Hampton Institute. Louise Ware writes in her biography of Peabody, he, Peabody, added that the national crisis, World War I, when every 199 man was needed, should ensure the Negro opportunity. Peabody was chairman of Combustion Engineering Corporation, president of Broadway Realtors, director of Mexican Lead Company, Mexican Coal and Coke, Mexican National Railways, Tezutlan Copper Refining and Smelting, and served as treasurer of the Democratic National Party. Despite his capitalist background, Peabody was always an avowed socialist. Ware notes that he wrote to Norman Thomas, I have always been most sympathetic to individual socialist aspirations. I have particularly observed the Fabian system of England with hopeful anticipations. This admirer of Fabian socialism is the man who helped install the General Education Board as the guiding force behind all educational developments in the U.S. since 1910. The Springfield Republican noted, October 1, 1866, for all who know anything of the subject know very well that Peabody and his partners in London gave us no faith and no help in our struggle for national existence. They participated to the full in the common English distrust of our cause and our success, and talked and acted for the South rather than for our nation. No individual contributed so much to flooding our money markets with the evidences of our debt in Europe, and breaking down fear persis and weakening financial confidence in nationality than George Peabody and Company, and none made more money by the operation. All the money that Mr. Peabody is giving away so lavishly among our institutions of learning was gained by the speculations of his house in our misfortunes. This editorial was also reprinted in the New York Times October 31, 1866. The writer did not know that Peabody was a front for the Rothschilds, or that the establishment of the Peabody Fund was intended to give them political and financial control of the impoverished South, or that it would inaugurate the era of foundations as the controlling factor in American life. John D. Rockefeller used General Education Board funds through Standard Oil representatives in Russia to provoke the Russian Revolution in 1905. No wonder the Soviet masses cheer when a Rockefeller arrives to visit them. To date, the Rockefellers have given more than $5 billion from stock income, meaning that Americans have had to ante up billions of dollars in taxes which would otherwise have been revenue on this income. Congressman Wright Padman, CHMN of the House Banking and Currency Committee, proved in 1967 hearings that one for Rockefeller foundations held assets of more $1 billion in Standard Oil stock. Not only did they pay no tax on this stock, but it gave them permanent control over the family-owned firm. Rival financiers could know TBU cap CONTTOLOF Standard Oil, because ITS stock was insulated by foundation ownership. As Padman pointed out, the fact th at the Rockefellers escaped paying huge sums in taxes gave them an unsurpassed market advantage over other firms which had to pay normal rates of tax. The agitation for increased corporate taxation adds to Rockefeller's advantage. Padman said, the foundations are the best investments the Rockefeller family could have made. A family member, Senator Nelson Aldrich, shepherded the General Education Board charter through Congress. The Rockefeller Foundation charter proved more difficult. It was a flagrant effort to evade government decrees against the Standard Oil monopoly, but was finally pushed through in 1913 by Senator Robert F. Wagner of NY, setting aside $50 million in Standard Oil of New Jersey stock for charitable work. The Rockefeller Foundation charter was signed on May 22, 1913. Its incorporators were John D. Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller Jr., Henry Pratt Judson, of the Lyman and Pratt families, president of University of Chicago, Simon Flexner, educated at University of Berlin and University of Strasbourg, had served with Rockefeller Institute since 1903 as prof of medicine, Star Jameson, personal counsel to John D. Rockefeller in his benevolences, Jerome D. Green, Secretary of Harvard Corporation 1910-11, banker with Lee Higginson of London. 1912-18, Seconds Reparations Commission at Paris Peace Conference, Wycliffe Rose, Professor Peabody College, Secretary Peabody Educational Fund, Trustee of Slater Fund and General Education Board, and Charles W. Elliott, also of the Lyman family, married Ellen Peabody, educated in Germany, President Emeritus of Harvard. An offshoot, the Kainan Medical Board, secured Standard Oil the market for oil for the lamps of China, and gave the family entree into the highly profitable Asiatic drug trade. The breakthrough was 200. 201. Obtained, after they financed the rise to power of the Soong family, who created modern China. The list of officers of the Rockefeller Foundation from 1913-63 reveals a great deal about this organization. The four chairmen of the board have been John D. Rockefeller Jr. 1917-1939, Walter D. Stewart, 1939-50, John Foster Dulles, 1950-52, and John D. Rockefeller III, 1952-63. Walter D. Stewart served with Bernard Barrick on the War Industries Board in 1918, was with the Federal Reserve Board from 1922-25, and then joined the law firm of Case, Pomery, a Rockefeller firm. He was economic advisor to the Bank of England 1928-30, special advisor to Bank for International Settlements 1931, Presidential Council of Economic Advisors for Eisenhower 1953-56, and later President of the Institute for Advanced Study. In this list of legal and financial posts, one is struck by the conspicuous absence of any charitable endeavors. John Foster Dulles, as senior partner of the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, carried on the firm's traditional involvement in promoting wars and revolutions. Few Americans know that Sullivan and Cromwell's intrigues made the Panama Canal possible. A 736-page volume, The Story of Panama, the U.S. House hearings on Panama in 1913, offers hundreds of pages of documentation proving that William Nelson Cromwell, founder of the firm, and Dulles' mentor, instigated and promoted the Panamanian Revolution for J.P. Morgan and J.N.W. Seligman. Morgan subsequently received $40 milfin in gold from the U.S. Treasury, the largest check it had ever drawn to that time. $35 million of this sum was clear profit. President Theodore Roosevelt sued the New York World for libel for printing some of the facts about himself and Cromwell. The case was unanimously thrown out of court by the Supreme Court. We find in the Roosevelt Panama libel case against the New York World the following, on October 3, 1908, the Democratic National 202 Committee was considering the advisability of making public a statement that William Nelson Cromwell in connection with M. Bonavirilla, a French speculator, had formed a syndicate at the time, when it was quite evident that the U.S. would take over the rights of French bondholders in the De Lesseps Canal, and that this syndicate included among others Charles P. Taft, brother of William Howard Taft, and Douglas Robinson, brother-in-law of President Theodore Roosevelt. These financiers invested their money, because of a full knowledge of the intention of the U.S. government to acquire the French property at a price of about $40 million and thus, because of the alleged information from government sources, were enabled to reap a rich profit. On August 29, the Democratic National Committee issued a statement from its headquarters in Chicago identifying Cromwell as William Nelson Cromwell of New York, the great Wall Street lawyer, attorney for the Panama Canal Combine, Kool-Aid Company, the Harriman Interests, the Sugar Trust, the Standard Oil Trust and others. Thus the Democratic leaders identified Cromwell as the lawyer for the seven men who controlled America for the Rothschilds. The Democrats continued, in September 1904, during the absences of Secretary Taft from Washington, Mr. Cromwell, a private citizen, practically ran the War Department. John F. Wallace, chief engineer of the Panama Canal, testified before the Senate Committee on February 5, 1905, Cromwell appeared to me to be a dangerous man. The House hearings devoted many pages to Cromwell's activities, well worth anyone's reading, including damning testimony from Congressman Rainey. The revolutionists were in the pay of the Panama Railroad and Steamship Company, a New Jersey corporation. The representative of that corporation was William Nelson Cromwell. He was the revolutionist who promoted and made possible the revolution on the Isthmus of Panama. At that time he was a shareholder in the railroad and its general counsel in the United States. William Nelson Cromwell, the most dangerous man this country has produced since the days of Aaron Burr, is a professional revolutionist. M. John Foster Dulles, chairman of the board of the Rockefeller Foundation, inherited the mantle of Cromwell as the most dangerous man in America. A member of the Rockefeller family through his marriage to Janet Pomeroy Avery, he was secretary to his uncle, Secretary of State Robert Lansing, at the Paris Peace Conference. Thomas Lamont, partner of J.P. Morgan, wrote of Dulles at that time, "All of us placed great reliance upon John Foster Dulles." Dulles later turned up in Germany with Baron Kurt von Schroeder to guarantee Hitler the funds to take over Germany. U.S. Ambassador to Germany William Dodd writes in his diary, Dec 4, 1933, "John Foster Dulles, legal counsel for Associated American Banks, called this afternoon to give an account of claims being urged on behalf of bondholders against German cities and corporations, more than $1 billion. He seemed very clever and resolute." Ron Prusin, in his biography of Dulles, mentions Dulles' secret discussions with the German cabinet Dec 1933 and January 1934 in Berlin. Prusin lists Dulles' banking clients during the 1920s, J. P. Morgan, the National City Company, Kuhn, Leib & Company, Dylan Reed, Guarantee Trust, Lee Higginson, and Brown Brothers Harriman. Dulles had a legal monopoly on Wall Street. John Foster Dulles never lost his penchant for starting wars. How many Americans know that it was John Foster Dulles who sent a telegram from Tokyo to President Truman's advisors, "If it appears that the South Koreans cannot repulse the attack, then we believe that U.S. force should be used." Although Dulles never revealed who we included, this telegram set off our involvement in the Korean War. Among the presidents of the Rockefeller Foundation, we find George E. Vincent, who was president of the Chautauqua Institution. He served with Herbert Hoover on the Commission for Relief in Belgium, Max Mason, president of the University of Chicago, to which the Rockefellers gave some $400 million, Raymond Blaine Fosdick, who served as secretary to the League of Nations, 1919-20, later was official biographer of John D. Rockefeller, his brother Harry Emerson Fosdick, who was pastor of Rockefeller's church, Chester I. Barnard, president of AT&T, director of the U.S. Telephone Agency during World War I, Dean Rusk, who served two presidents, as Secretary of State, and J. George Herer, who was Andrew D. White professor at Cornell. The secretaries of the Rockefeller Foundation are Jerome D. Green, who was secretary to the president of Harvard 191-5, and on the board of Harvard Overseers 1911-1950, secretary of the Reparations Commission under Bernard Barrick at the Paris Peace Conference 1919, general manager of the Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research 1901-1939, director of Brookings Institution 1928-1945, and chairman of the notorious Rockefeller Financed Institute of Pacific Relations, of which Lawrence Rockefeller was secretary, and which had close relations with the Soviets by Richard Sorge in Japan, Edwin R. Embry, who set up the Julius Rosenwald Foundation in 1917 for the well-being of mankind, seven of whose trustees were identified as members of Communist Front organizations. Vice presidents of the Rockefeller Foundation, since 1913, include Roger S. Green, the organizer of the Committee to Defend America by Aiding the Allies, whose purpose was to involve us in World War II and who served with the Department of State from 194044, and Alan Grigg, who served with the British Expeditionary Force 1917-19. All of these officers also are listed as directors of the Rockefeller Foundation. Other directors include the Lord Franks, British ambassador to the U.S. 1948-52, a key member of the London Connection which operates the United States as a colony of the British Empire. He is a director of the Rhodes Trust, the Schroeder Bank, visiting professor at the University of Chicago, chairman of Lloyds Bank, and presently chancellor of East Anglia University. Charles Evans Hughes, governor of New York, presidential candidate who is believed to have actually defeated Woodrow Wilson in 1916, later Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, appointed to that post by his good friend Herbert Hoover, James R. Angel, CHM in National Research Council. 1919-20, president of the Carnegie Corporation, president of Yale. His daughter is Mrs. William Rockefeller. He was a director of New. 204. 205. York Life and NBC. Trevor Arnott, president of the International Board of Education. Harry Pratt Judson, president, University of Minnesota. President, American University in China, director of Rockefeller's China Medical Board. Vernon Kellogg, Herbert Hoover's assistant in the U.S. Food Administration, during World War I and the American Relief Administration 1919-21, later Secretary, National Research Council, and trustee of Brookings Institution. Star Murphy, who lists himself in Who's Who as the personal counsel and representative of John D. Rockefeller in his benevolences. Wycliffe Rose, director of public health, Rockefeller Foundation 1913-23, President Peabody College 1892-22, Agent Peabody Education Fund 1907-15, Rockefeller Sanitary Commission and Southern Educational Board 1909-15, International Health Board 1913-28, President, General Education Board 1913-28, International Education Board 1923-28, Director, Red Cross and Atlantic Council, A. Barton Hepburn, Superintendent, Banks New York State 188083, Chief Bank Examiner New York 188892, Controller U.S. Army 1892-93, Vice President National Citibank 1897-99, President Chase National Bank 1899-1922, Member Federal Advisory Council, Federal Reserve System, 1918, Director New York Life, Sears, Woolworth, Studebaker, Texas Company, Joyous Rosenwald, set up Rosenwald Foundation to carry on Peabody Fund agitation in the South, total involvement. He also gave $700,000 to Rockefeller's University of Chicago, was trustee Baron D. Hirsch Fund, Zionist Settlement Program, Martin A. Ryerson, President Board of Trustees University of Chicago, trustee Carnegie Institution, Carl T. Compton, assigned to American Embassy Paris 1918, he was CHMN U.S. Radar Mission to USSR 1943, SPEC, Representative Secretary of War 1943-44, SPEC, Adds Atomic Development 1945, achieved immortality, as the man who told President Truman to drop the atomic bomb on Japan, the first use of this horror weapon, also Director of Ford Foundation, Sloan Kettering Institute, Royal Society of London, John W. Davis, lawyer for Morgan and Rockefeller, Ambassador to Britain 1918-21, Democratic candidate President 1924, John Sloan Dickey, with Department State 194045, President Dartmouth, served on President's Commission on Civil Rights, Harold W. Dodds, President Princeton, was Herbert Hoover's Executive Secretary, U.S. Food Administration 1917-19, Trustee Brookings Institution and Carnegie Foundation, Director, Prudential Insurance. 206. Lewis W. Douglas, Grad. Oxford, married Peggy Zinser, Director of Budget 193334, President American CINAMID, Ambassador to Great Britain 1947, Chairman of Board Metropolitan Life, Director General Motors, Homestake Mining Company, Orville Dreyfus, who married Marion Salzberger and became Chairman of New York Times, Trustee Baron D. Hirsch Fund, Lee A. DuBridge, President California Institute of Technology, Trustee Rand Corporation Member U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, awarded the King's Medal for Service to Great Britain 1943, David Leon Edsall, Dean Harvard Medical School 1918-35, Charles William Elliott, who married Ellen Peabody, studied European educational methods, President of Harvard for many years, promoted Hegelian School of Determinism, Simon Flexner, who studied at University of Berlin, University of Strasbourg, set up Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research, member Royal Society of London, many medical societies, Douglas Freeman, editor Richmond News Leader, director Woodrow Wilson Foundation, Equitable Life, Herbert S. Gasser, organized Chemical Warfare Service 1918, fellow Royal Society, London and Edinburgh, Frederick T. Gates, lists himself as business and benevolent representative John D. Rockefeller 1893-1912, Walter S. Gifford, organized U.S. Council Naval Defense 1916-18, formed to involve us in World War I, invited by Colonel Howes to serve on U.S. Inter-Allied Council 1918, President et, Chairman of Board of Carnegie Institution, Robert F. Goheen, President Princeton 195772, Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, Smithsonian Institution, Institute of International Education, Dreyfus Fund, Board of Overseers Harvard University. Carnegie Foundation, Herbert Spencer Headley, as Attorney General of Missouri, prosecuted Standard Oil. They then backed him for governor. He served from 1909-13. Wallace K. Harrison, architect Rockefeller Center and UN Building, Theodore Hesburgh, President Notre Dame University, Woodrow Wilson Fellowship, Carnegie Foundation, Ford Foundation, Rockefeller Brothers Fund, Hoover Commission, Ernest M. Hopkins, Assistant to Secretary of War 1918, Office of Procurement and Management. 1941, President Dartmouth 1916-45, Arthur A. Coden, CHMN Corning Glass, Office Price Management 1941-42, Adcom on Arts Federal Reserve System, Director New York Life, U.S. Trust, J.P. Morgan Library, Clark Kerr, President University of California 1952-73, Robert A. Lovett, married Adele Brown, of Brown Brothers, he, 207, was partner Brown Brothers Harriman 1926-61. Spec, asked Secretary of War 1942-41, Secretary War for Air 1941-45, under Secretary State 1947-49, replaced James A. Forrestal, as Secretary of Defense when Forrestal fell from window at Naval Hospital, served as Secretary Defense 19552, Director Royal Globe Insurance of London, New York Life, Freeport. Sulphur, Chairman Union Pacific, Director Carnegie Institute. His father, Judge Robert S. Lovett, was attorney for UP, advised Harriman and Kahn not to answer questions about their stock dealings. All records burned in 1911. Benjamin McKelway, editor Washington Star, Henry Allen Moe, Rhodes Scholar, ran Guggenheim Foundation for many years, barrister of Inner Temple, London, CHMN Museum of Modern Art set up by Rockefeller family, also Knapp Endowment for the Humanities, William Myers, director Federal Reserve Bank of NY, president, Committee on Foreign Aid 1947, Director Carnegie Foundation, ARCO, Smith Corona, Continental Can, Grand Union, Mutual Life, Thomasville. Parkinson, Adj. General U.S. Army 191819, Chairman Equitable Life, Chase Nattel Bank, at Borden, Thomas Perrin, Surgeon General U.S. 1936-48, Alfred N. Richards, Staff British Medical Research 1917-18, Organized U.S. Chemical Warfare Service 1918, Dean Rusk, Rhodes Scholar, joined Department State 1946, important role with John Foster Dulles in involving U.S. in Korean War. Assistant Secretary, War 1946-47, UN Affairs Department State 1947-49, President Rockefeller Foundation 1950-60, Secretary of State 1961-69, Jeffrey S. Smith, married into Coolidge family, Council Nattel Refugee Commission 1940, OPM 1941, War Production Board 1942, President Gerard Trust, Director Bell Telephone, Robert G. Sproul, President University of California, his brother Alan was President Federal Reserve Bank of New York for many years, Robert was Director Institute of International Education, Carnegie Foundation, American Group on Allied Reparations 1945, Citizens Committee for the Marshall Plan, Institute of Pacific Relations, Frank Stanton, Howie 1942-45, President of CBS for many years, Robert T. Stevens, Chairman of Family Firm J.T. Stevens, Giant Textile Firm, Director Federal Reserve Bank of New York, J.P. Morgan, General Electric, General Foods, New York Telephone, Secretary Army 1953-55, involved in McCarthy hearings, George D. Woods, Chairman First Boston, Kaiser Steel, General Staff U.S. Army 194245, Director New York Times, Arthur M. Woods, Assistant Secretary War World War I, Director of Rockefeller Firm Colorado Fuel and Iron, Scene of Massacre of Workers, Ludlow Massacre, Owen D. Young, Chairman General Electric, Director RCA, American Foreign Power, General Motors NBC RICO, Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Agent General for Reparations Payments 1919-24, chosen by Bernard Barrick, Winthrop Aldrich, Rockefeller Family Member, Chairman Chase National Bank, Director at International Paper, Metropolitan Life, Westinghouse, Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Rockefeller Center, served as ambassador. Great Britain 1953-57, Barry Bingham, editor Louisville Courier Journal, served in Europe 1942-45, special mission to France for ICA 1949-50, Chester Bowles, founded ad agency Benton and Bowles, served with OPA WPBY, ambassador to India 1951-53, Woodrow Wilson Foundation, partner Senator William Benton, Lloyd D. Brace, president. First National Bank, Director at Gillette, John Hancock, Stone & Webster, U.S. Smelting, Richard Bradfield, educated at University of Berlin, married into Stillman Family Guggenheim Fellow, carried out Far Eastern policy for Rockefeller Foundation, as head division of agriculture 1955-57, Dieter Bronk, President. Rockefeller Institute Medical Research, Sloan Kettering Institute, received Order of British Empire, William H. Claflin, Treasurer Harvard, Ralph Bunch, educated at Harvard and London School of Economics, with British Section OSS 1941-44, Department State 1944-47, Dumbarton Oaks 1944, UN at San Francisco with Alger Hiss 1945, UN London 1945, UNT, Secretary UN 1947-71, Palestine Mediator 1948 after Count Bernadette was assassinated by Begin. See Douglas Dillon born Switzerland 1909, Director U.S. and Foreign Securities 1937-63, Chairman Dillon Reed 1946-53, Ambassador to France 1953-57, Under Secretary State 1958. 1960, helped Bechtel obtain Arabian contracts, Bechtel later bought out his family firm, Dillon Reed, Secretary of Treasury 1960-65, is Trustee Brookings Institute. Hoover Institution, Heritage Foundation, his daughter is Princess Joan of Luxembourg, married into family which is direct descendant of William of Orange who chartered the Bank of England, Edward Robinson, was with Peabody Company, Spencer Trask Company Treasurer Rockefeller Foundation and General Adduction Board. 1938-62, Kenneth Warnemont, joined Institute of International Education 1937, Department of Agriculture 1938-46 in Latin America, Mexican Missions for Rockefeller, Charles W. Cole, President. Amherst. 208.